Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the Church today.
Today we continue with our discussion on Philip Melanchthon with Dr. Robert Rosin. He is professor of historical theology at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, and Bob has taught all around the world, but specifically he focuses about half of the year teaching in Europe, and he's currently here as a tutor at Westfield House. And we were talking last time about Philip Melanchthon, but particularly you were giving us some background, and we stopped at really the foundation of the University of Wittenberg, where Melanchthon and Luther both taught, and you were telling us about how humanism was the real foundation stone of this new university. So could you fill us in a bit more on exactly what this meant and how it affected Melanchthon, and how he and Luther both used this tool to bring about the Reformation?
Renaissance humanism, not modern secular humanism, was really an educational movement, a kind of curricular movement. Last time we talked about the classical era learning of the trivium, grammar, logic, rhetoric, and the quadrivium, arithmetic or mathematics, geometry, astronomy, meaning sciences, and music, meaning the arts. Those liberal arts were there in classical antiquity, lost a bit during the Middle Ages. Logic came to dominate, especially after Aristotle was rediscovered in the 12th century, so to speak. They always knew a little bit about Aristotle, but his writings, especially his analytics, as they're called, posterior analytics that deal with logical thought, came to the West again in translation. And that was just the absolutely wonderful method, thought the universities, for organizing their thought. That causes other things to go into eclipse. Middle of the 14th century, there starts to be a revival of the old liberal arts, of a renaissance of humanism, of the study of mankind, studio humanitatis. The Renaissance really offered a kind of five-point alternative core. They wanted to emphasize grammar again, go back to the simple communication, poetry, the affective side of human nature, the heart. Poetry is not logical. Poetry is something you just know when it clicks. It touches a kind of a deeper tone within human feeling, human thought. Grammar, poetry, rhetoric is there again, the persuasion of speech. History was another core subject. History was a look at past life. History used to be simply a subset of rhetoric, kind of a way to illustrate. But now we've gone a long time since classical antiquity. They understand that times have changed, cultures and contexts have changed. They'd look at how people dealt with problems then, and then how, what do we do with them now? And then and of course, history can't always be solved by logic either. Life is full of ragged edges in the past. Moral philosophy, the fifth subject of Renaissance humanism's core curriculum. That's another way of saying ethics. That's modern day ragged edges of life. How do we deal with those? And again, logic can't always answer these things. You wind up with dilemmas where you have to choose sort of better or worse and try and persuade people of the answer. This Renaissance humanist core was around universities, but not in universities, except at Wittenberg. Wittenberg was founded in 1502. Back in the latter part of the 15th century, the territory of Saxony was divided between two brothers. The university went to one side that was known as Ducal Saxony. The other side of Saxony got the vote for the emperor. That was the elector of Saxony. In Luther's day, that was Frederick the Wise, but no university in that territory. And so Frederick began a university in the year 1502. Wittenberg copied Tübingen's bylaws and structure, so to speak, its organizational pattern. But it was a new university, and what's significant about Wittenberg is that Frederick, he's a really shrewd guy, Frederick is. I mean, he's often slow in acting, but he carefully contemplates things and then makes his decision. He decided that Wittenberg, in order to have its own little twist and find its niche, it would be different. And so in the charter for the University of Wittenberg, at the very end, after laying out what it plans to do, the typical kind of mission statement things you'd see and find, it invites people to come to this new place of learning, which will be teaching, as the charter said, poesy and the arts. Poesy is poetry, one of those five core subjects of Renaissance humanism, and the arts is the rest of the liberal arts, not just scholastic logic. Logic would be there, but logic was going to have to fight for a place in the curriculum with the rest of the liberal arts. So Frederick started this new university, opened up the doors, and let all sorts of professors come and kind of sort it out. You know, let the students vote with their feet, so to speak, and see what proves to be attractive. Well, early on, Wittenberg is a bit of a revolving door. Humanists see the opportunity to be on regular faculty at Wittenberg. That's attractive. Unfortunately, Wittenberg is a town of about 2,000 to 2,500 people. That's not attractive. It was a sandy hill on a sluggish spot on the Elbe River. I mean, they call it Wittenberg, White Mountain, and the university is called the Leukorea, the White Mountain of the university. That's grand in terms of rhetoric. In fact, it was a pretty dumpy place, all things considered. And so humanists will come, and then there's thought, oh, maybe a university here or a university there will open up, you know, some other better place, a more established school, a better place to live. And so they come and they go. They're always looking for grass greener on the other side of the fence somewhere. But they came and they were allowed in. The first rector of the university was a humanist, a poet. I won't bother you with the names. It doesn't much matter for the listeners, but I think it's interesting that people early on in positions of shaping the school and shaping the faculty came from a humanist background. So they had scholastic logic there, and the scholastics would very easily have moved in and seized control of the whole place, but the humanists wouldn't let that happen. They fought for places on the faculty. They wanted a ranking equal with the others. Luther came to Wittenberg for one semester in 1508-1509 as a kind of fill-in guest instructor. He lectured on Lombard sentences. This was a kind of dogmatics text of the late Middle Ages. Luther hated it because there was a prescribed curriculum he had to follow with all the kind of logic. The plan was there. You basically kind of read the script, followed the pattern, and Luther said it was boring, dull, just awful. He came back in 1511 to finish his own theological work, get his doctor's degree, and then he stayed on to teach at Wittenberg. He stayed because he's an Augustinian monk. He has no money to pay for schooling. The Augustinian order had no money to pay either. They had paid graduation fees for several other Augustinians. They're broke. And so Frederick the Wise saw a chance here to get himself faculty at a bargain basement price. And so Luther gets his degree in exchange for a promise to stay there and teach as long as Frederick has use of him and has need of him. And Frederick would have to tell him to leave. And Frederick never said leave, so Luther just stayed. In that decade, that first decade there at the university, from 1512 on as he's a professor, Luther saw the benefit of Renaissance humanism himself. I wouldn't call him a humanist, because humanists are sometimes interested in learning just in its own sake. They like poetry just for the sake of poetry. Luther likes it because poetry is a way of teaching Christian doctrine, for example, through hymns, let us say, or through rhymes that would teach lessons to laity, you know, ways to kind of remember the doctrine, because it sticks in memory with the rhythm and the rhyme of poetry. So Luther saw benefit and value in this, and he agitates for Renaissance humanism because he himself was coming to a new understanding. He was using the grammars, the dictionaries, the word books, the comments on biblical texts that were coming out of, trickling in out of different quarters of Renaissance humanism. Luther's putting them together, and he comes to a breakthrough somewhere. in that decade. We don't quite know when it was. We wished he'd dated it and put it in there, but there is this time where he says the gates of paradise were flung wide open. Could be that it's he's standing at the end of the decade, looks back and says, wow, look where I've come over the course of 10 years. That's, to my way of thinking, probably most likely what happened, because there is no one day where he sort of says, you know, today I turned the corner. Over that course of the decade, he gradually comes to understand the scriptures better and better, and he does it through the understanding of grammar, of the words, not through the use of logic. Let the texts speak. These texts describe real life. They describe God engaging his people in the Old Testament and again in the New in terms of law and promise, or law and gospel. They show God dealing with people in terms of real life in their daily problems, giving them salvation, giving them hope for deliverance. They look forward for the Messiah in the Old Testament, and they look for his return again after the New Testament Gospels, heading forward. We live in that kind of end time now already. This view of God dealing with his people in terms of real life, Luther says, is the same thing we carry forward into our own church today. We don't expect new revelations from God. There's nothing more for Christ to do. We could talk about that sometime, about the end times and how to sort of visualize this, because there are a lot of people who run around today and say, oh, we have to decode history, understand what's happening so we can find out when Christ is going to come again. The answer to that, on the one hand, is very simple, and on the other hand, it's still very mysterious, very open-ended. But Luther saw that the scriptures describe life, God's dealing with people in life. The texts are different because they're reliable. These are God's inspired word. They're not just like ordinary histories, but they do talk about life, about how God deals with, again, as I said, law and promise. Same with us. That living in faith is a kind of existential or relational connection between the believer and God. All of that depends not on a thinking through of logic, but again, a thinking through of the grammar, reading the accounts that are there, seeing it as a kind of description of history again, of life. What Luther saw then was a need to bring more and more Renaissance humanism into the university. And over the course of the decade, he agitates for scholastics who are there to be kind of elbowed out, or they will leave, take a job elsewhere. Get somebody new in. Get somebody in to teach New Testament based on the Greek text, not another logician, see? One of the biggest things, and this is how Melanchthon now gets to the university, is that Luther saw the need to emphasize languages. At the universities, languages would be taught, as I said, kind of outside the curriculum. And in Louvain, for example, Leuven, in Belgium, modern-day Belgium, there was a famous Catholic university that taught Latin, Greek, and Hebrew, but it did for non-credit, so to speak, outside the normal curriculum. Wittenberg is different. Luther is always agitating for change. In 1517, the elector sent visitors to the university to sort of see how things were going. There had been some complaints that the law professors maybe not quite teaching all their courses they're supposed to do. You know, I think of that like modern universities. Oh, they're off consulting someplace, you know. I don't know if that was the case, but there were some complaints. And so they came to see what was going on at Frederick's University. He's very concerned about this. And so Luther, being a shrewd guy, does what you always do when you get these kind of accreditation visitations, so to speak. You give them suggestions of all the things you'd like to have changed, say. I mean, if you've got people coming in who are going to have something to say about the scope and the direction of the university, feed them the stuff and get them to suggest it. And one of the things he suggested was that they teach languages. And so Wittenberg got itself what they called a pedagogium, a language trio of Latin, Greek, and Hebrew in the curriculum, not outside, in the curriculum required of students. If you're going to especially study theology, you're going to have to do these languages. Now you need a prof. And who should we get? We've been going on here for a while without mentioning Melanchthon's name, but the fact is it was Melanchthon. We left him back at Tübingen, where he was doing some lectures on some classical writers and writing his Greek grammar in 1518. 1518 is when the pedagogium starts in Wittenberg. They go hunting for a prof, And after several people are suggested, Frederick settles in on Philip Melanchthon, this young guy who's brought in to teach there. When Melanchthon arrived, people looked at him and said, "This guy?" I mean, he was not an imposing figure physically. He was a little bit sort of stooped, a little bit, I guess a little bit misshapen, you might say. I mean, he's not going to excel at sports. This was not his forte. He had a thin, kind of weak voice, Melanchthon did. He's not very impressive in terms of the public presentation. But he gave an inaugural lecture at Wittenberg on the study of youth, not studying youth, but the youth's studies, what they should be about. And he laid out this wonderful program of Renaissance humanist education and what this could do for opening up people's minds and opening up the possibilities for the state, for government, for society, for the home. And people were just enthralled by this speech. It was just, you know, it was wonderful. And he'd arrived.
Now that Melanchthon has arrived at Wittenberg, what were his responsibilities and roles, and how was he accepted by Luther at the beginning?
Melanchthon came as the Greek prof, simply put. They're the one to be part of this trio of languages that are part of the curriculum. Greek prof, but very quickly they saw that he had talents in other areas. He gave informal lectures in theology. Theology was one of the last things he personally had turned to in the course of his own educational development. He hit upon it, though, and liked it, and he used his languages to study, especially the New Testament, of course. He was doing this kind of on the side at Wittenberg, and other people encouraged him then to do this in a more formal way. Melanchthon eventually did get a B.A., or a Bachelor of Theology, B.T.H., I guess you'd say, at Wittenberg, a simple theological degree. He never went beyond that. He refused to go and take doctoral studies. That was just something he thought he didn't need, he didn't want. But he had at least a credential so that he had the right then to lecture in theology. And he did that as well. Eventually, then he was taken out of the liberal arts faculty, the kind of undergrad faculty, you might say, and put into the advanced faculty of theology. So he lectured always on philology, on languages. He had a student following there. He actually, though, got larger student crowds for his theology lectures. Probably the most famous of these were his little night lectures, as they were called. He was doing these, walking students through the book of Romans, giving them kind of key ideas from Romans. These lectures turned into what we know today as the loci communes, the commonplaces of Philip Melanchthon. Sometimes people say this is the first systematic theology. I'm not sure I'd quite say that. I mean, Melanchthon is organized. There's no doubt about that. There's a book called The Renaissance Concepts of Method, looking at key Renaissance thinkers. Melanchthon is one of the chapters there, and it looks at his intellectual organizational system, you might say, the way he thought through things. So he's organized, to be sure. But the loci communes is not really a kind of modern systematics. There's no kind of prolegomena, no ground rules laid out. It's not complete. There's nothing in there about God, Trinity, things like that. It's rather key subjects or key ideas in the book of Romans, sin, law, grace, things that are there that the normal, ordinary Christian would think about and wonder about. It was a little book that went through many, many editions during his lifetime and even thereafter was expanded still. It became more and more of a kind of doctrinal collection as he would add more subjects as time went on, a little like Calvin did with his Institutes. Calvin's book started with a few small chapters, too, and grew to two volumes. Melanchthon added and added and added, and as he changed his mind, some things would change. Later editions of the Loci Communes raised eyebrows from people. In 1535, for example, Melanchthon talked about how are we converted? Well, we are converted as the result of God's word and the Spirit's working and our will. And some people said, "Oh, that makes you. It means that you're saying that humans cooperate in their salvation." Well, he said, "No, the will doesn't do it by itself. The will has to be moved by God, enabled by God, but then has to respond now that it's made able to respond." it's probably not the best way to put things, frankly. I mean, he's trying to explain this for the ordinary people, people sitting there saying, well, you know, am I just a lump here that does nothing? Why is the pastor talking to me? If I can make no decision on myself, why does the pastor sit on my sofa and talk to me about Christianity? See? I mean, there must be some way I can respond. And Melanchthon's trying to sort of answer those sorts of questions. But it opens the door to saying I'm somehow cooperating in my salvation. That's an unfortunate part. The question, of course, is a logical one, if we can use logic with a humanist like Melanchthon. You know, why in the world does the pastor talk to me? Well, on a psychological level, this thinking about the message goes on. On a purely spiritual level of conversion, we know from, reminded by Luther's Small Catechism, I cannot by my own reason or strength believe in Jesus my Lord or come to him, but the Holy Spirit's called me by the gospel. Melanchthon understands that as well. He's not denying that. He's just trying to kind of work on different levels here. The problem is it becomes confusing, and it gives the suggestion that we're somehow responsible for our salvation. And that was the kind of thing that gave people pause occasionally about Melanchthon.
And it's my understanding it wasn't just this that gave people pause about Melanchthon, but there were some other issues.
Yeah, there in 1541, Melanchthon was involved at the Regensburg Colloquy. Regensburg is in southeast the empire, part of modern-day Bavaria. Melanchthon met with a very irenic, a very kind of open-minded Roman Catholic theologian named Julius Pflug. P-F-L-U-G is the last name. Pflug was trying to, from his side, build part of a bridge, Melanchthon from his own, to see if they could not still come to some sort of understanding. You have to remember, in this time, the Lutherans aren't saying, oh, we're a separate church. No, no, they are trying to reform within the church. They think that their way of explaining things better suits the biblical message, the biblical texts that they could read in the Greek, the grammar that they understood. And so Melanchthon and Pflug were trying to understand the essential issue of justification. They came to a kind of understanding that's sometimes called double justification. That is to say, on one level, God justifies. He makes the sinner righteous. At the same time, there is a kind of growing in grace, growing in the Christian life, where our righteousness seems to constantly be kind of unfolding, a kind of public justification. And this second justification is the kind of ongoing connection with works in the Christian life that Melanchthon still wanted to emphasize without making salvation works righteous. This could be confusing, of course. Melanchthon at one point got involved in a controversy later over the phrase good works are necessary, or good works on the other side are detrimental to salvation. Well, necessary how? We'll come to that perhaps a little later, another time. But here at this moment, in 1541, with Julius Pflug, they thought they had come to a kind of common understanding over the kind of justification in God's eyes and then justification in the world's eyes around. A little like looking at, let's say, Paul in Romans or Galatians, and then again the Epistle of James. See, faith without works is dead. How does this look on the kind of second level? The problem was each then went home to his own side, and Rome was not pleased with what Pflug has done. They thought he'd sold out, given up too much. And the Lutherans thought the same of Melanchthon, that he had bent over too far, too much, and conceded too much to Pflug. He should have been tougher on justification alone. Things like this cause people at times to raise an eyebrow about Melanchthon. See, is he with the program? Is he on the same wavelength as the rest of the Wittenbergers? I think worth knowing is that Luther would always sit down with Melanchthon. They'd discuss these kind of things when the controversies would arise, these questions about Melanchthon's direction and his ideas. You know, sit down, have a beer, talk them over, and Luther and Melanchthon would come to an understanding. Luther would say, yeah, he's okay, he just means to say that, and then would come the explanation. Maybe he could have said it better, but. And Luther, in the end, would he's not, you know, tossing him out of the family by any means. He's not always happy with what Melanchthon does, but he can kind of understand it, live with it. Melanchthon was important. Melanchthon was great for the constant work he did on the revisions of the Bible translations. His language knowledge, his textual knowledge was invaluable. And he was a very good organizer of Lutheran theological thought. The Augsburg Confession, of course, is his product. We really maybe could talk about that sometime as well. And his organizing skills show up also in the matter of education. Melanchthon, of course, himself was a product of Renaissance humanist education. There's a German historian, a man named Bernd Muller, who once wrote, "No humanism, no Reformation." Humanism was key, was essential for the Reformation breakthrough with its emphasis on language, its understanding of the New Testament. Melanchthon understood that. He benefited from this, and he wanted to see this same kind of curriculum in schools elsewhere. And so another reason he's important to keep within the movement is for his pedagogy. He's called the Praecepter Germaniae, the teacher of Germany, because of all the advice that he offered on how to organize schools and how to run their curricula. The so-called New School in Nuremberg in 1524-25 was opened with a curriculum that Melanchthon designed. Elsewhere, he would make visits of parishes of in different areas of Saxony and beyond, see what they were doing, and again, advise them on their school curriculum so that they would have Renaissance liberal arts education coupled also with Christian education, reading the texts and applying these to daily life. Study history, one of those subjects. Then turn to dealing with everyday life around us, the moral philosophy, so to speak, the ethics. This is absolutely crucial. Melanchthon did this. It's not cookie cutter. It's not sort of one size fits all. He, along with a man like Johannes Bugenhagen, who also did this, they paid close attention to the local circumstances and designed school curricula really to fit local circumstances. That kind of organization is important. It's important because, you see, if you think of the Reformation as a kind of revolution, you can't go on a revolution on overdrive constantly. Eventually, you have to kind of settle down and regularize things to communicate this to the next generations that come along. Education is one way of doing that in a kind of organized, patterned way. Not deadly dull, not forced into scholastic logical boxes, but again, with the freedom of the liberal arts, but yet with a clear anchor and a firm direction. Melanchthon did that. He was very good at that, and for that, the movement owed him a great deal of thanks. There are other things as well. Augsburg Confession, above all, some other writings of his, and some controversies to come. Those are all still things worth looking at a little bit to try and get a measure of the man, maybe some other time.
And those will be topics that we will be examining in our third and concluding episode with Dr. Robert Rosin. Again, Bob, we thank you for your time, and we look forward to being with you next week, and we invite our listeners back to join us then.
Thank you for listening to The Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.